What explains the recent mania for toppling statues in America? Well, it might have something to do with the internet. Joseph Bottom heads the Cyber Ethics Program at Dakota State University in Madison. He's also a contributing editor to the Weekly Standard. He wrote a piece in the September 25th issue of the magazine called The Joy of Destruction. He joins us now from Madison with more. Dr. Bottom, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Fascinating article. For one thing, I had no idea that that so many cities throughout the country were sort of dealing with this issue. But I think we ought to start with the story of Josh Coben, if that's how you say his name. And tell me a little bit about how he is this metaphor for a larger, a larger movement happening in America.
Well, poor Josh, you know, he's such a sad sack in a variety of ways. But he was he works at GoDaddy down in Arizona, which is, I think, the largest of the internet registration firms. And, you know, he heard that the president was coming this August to Arizona, and so he joined a protest and marched down with his gas mask to protest the president as a fascist. And the police tried to disperse the crowd and ended up firing some tear gas canisters. And he picked up one of the tear gas canisters, flung it back at the police, only to discover that he'd burned his hand because tear gas canisters are hot. And then, while he was licking his hand, the police fired again, and a ball of pepper spray hit him in the groin. And he collapsed to the ground like something out of a movie, you know? I mean, that same kind of stereotypical, exaggerated response. And, of course, it was captured on video, and then somebody posted it to YouTube, and Josh seemed to like the attention, so he claimed credit for it, whereupon the local television station interviewed him, and he said he didn't think throwing things at the police was assaulting them, but the police did think throwing things at the police was assaulting them, and they had no trouble identifying him, and they arrested him. And my point with starting with this long lead, this long introduction to, right, you know, a 5,000-word piece that has a 1,000-word introduction, was to try and say, look at how every element of this would have been impossible 20 years ago.
Right.
Because every single element of it is driven by the internet. He finds out about the president's visit from discussion feeds he follows planning the protest. He becomes famous because of, relatively famous, because of the filming of it. He gets arrested because he exposes himself or he admits to his activities on the internet. Mm-hmm. Every single element of this is driven by the internet. And I began to think of the parallels and the similar patterns by which, for example, one of only many examples, the agitation around the country about statuary is driven by the internet. It happens at such speed that the social contagion spreads with no time for nuance, no time for consideration, no time for stepping back and thinking a little bit. The agitation just builds and builds and builds. And it seemed to me to follow patterns that had been suggested by the anthropologist René Girard. And so I wrote that piece for the Weekly Standard.
You argue as well, I believe, that maybe someone like Josh, the lines of for what was allowable or what he could get away with, what was legal, what was illegal, what the consequences would be, are also blurred, perhaps because of the internet and computer connectivity. He's sort of, the nuances are not sinking in.
Well, that's certainly true, and I think you make a really nice point, Laurie, when you point out that in some ways he's confusing the virtual with the real.
Right.
You can say really hot things about the president on your Reddit thread, but there's a difference between that and the real heat that a tear gas canister has. Reality and the virtual are not the same. But you begin to think they are. You can call the police pigs and denounce them, even threaten them on Twitter. But if you actually pick up a canister and throw it at them, you've committed assault.
Right.
There's a sort of interesting confusion happening that confusion is the vector down which social contagion spreads.
How widespread did the removal or the defacing or vandalizing of statues throughout America come? How fast did that spread once it really began?
When did it begin? I'm not sure. I certainly did not know of this movement more than 2 years ago.
Right.
Right now, or in the last month and a half, over 100 cities and towns in America have begun to remove Confederate memorials.
And another thing I found fascinating was, you know, how could there be so many? And it's, you know, there's memorials to the Confederacy in places that you wouldn't necessarily think would have a memorial to the Confederacy. Tell us a little bit about what's behind that.
There's a fountain in Helena, Montana.
Right.
You know, I mean, Helena, Montana was not part of the Confederacy. Much of that had to do with what Busy Beavers, the daughters of the Confederacy, were from about 1910 or 1900 through to about 1960. And they were just, you know, they were putting up plaques and memorials. The Episcopal Diocese of New York City announced that they were removing a plaque to Robert E. Lee that commemorated a tree he had planted in Brooklyn when he was posted there before the war.
Hmm.
And my thought was, who puts up
a tree
that Robert E. Lee planted in Brooklyn? Well, the answer, of course, is the
Daughters of the Confederacy.
And I don't believe that racism was their primary motive. It was certainly present because it was omnipresent in the South through Jim Crow. But I don't believe it was their primary motive, nor do I believe that they had any motive to have the Confederacy rise again.
Mm.
What they were actually doing most of all, I think, is responding to the loss of their fathers, their grandfathers, their uncles, their great uncles. As the generation, you know, starting around 1890, as the generation that had actually experienced the Civil War began to pass away, these, you know, middle class socialites, what in other towns, other cities would have belonged to the Junior League, they began to mourn the loss of the generation, their fathers, their grandfathers, that had experienced the war, that had had such intense experiences. And they started to finance memorials to them. And it became a social club for women in the South. And the primary motive there was, I think, not what we ascribe to these statues now. But the statues are interpreted now in the worst possible way. That they had an element of that badness in them is obviously true, but it's very interesting today that the protesters who are winning, these memorials are coming down all over the place, have chosen the worst possible interpretation of these statues.
Is there an intimidation factor to, you know, the statues and, you know, what they say to people today? Is there an ominous nature to some of it?
I think if we feel it so, you know, the protests and the deaths in Charlottesville in August began not with the white supremacists marching to the statue out of the blue. They were protesting a city council vote to remove the statue. So removing the statue actually came first. It strikes me that the city council of Charlottesville, Virginia, was responding to pressure from people who had decided to be outraged about that statue of Robert E. Lee. Nobody was noticing it before this group of mostly college students at the University of Virginia began to complain about it, and then the city council acted rapidly to remove it. Was there an intimidation factor when the statue was first put up? Probably. Some, sure. But the intimidation right now is coming from the people who want the statues removed.
I'm curious, going back to the story we talked about at the beginning of the protest, the, you know, Antifa-related protest. How has this changed? How has the internet and how we use the internet changing the way that we exercise our First Amendment rights.
You know, I fear lots and lots of college students, lots and lots of young people have kind of ceased to believe in free speech. Director of the ACLU was just shouted down at William & Mary University the other day, yesterday, the day before, with shouts that liberalism was white privilege, and that the idea of defending free speech, which of course the ACLU has always done, made them the equivalent of Hitler. And it was a fascinating moment. You know, now, as one observer of the French Revolution remarked, the revolution is like Saturn, like the Greek god Saturn. It devours its own children. The people who start the revolution get eaten up by it. But it's a fascinating moment in which, you know, this kind of radical left is turning on the old mainstream left and denouncing the ACLU, which is a pretty standard liberal democratic institution. And it's now being denounced as Hitlerian. And that's a fascinating turn in American politics. But I think you're right, Laurie, to observe that it's driven in many ways by the Internet, because the Internet makes it happen so quickly.
Right.
That there's no time for thought, there's no time for nuance, there's no time for adults to step in and kind of derail the thing. I see in the piece that the glory of the Internet is that it allows like-minded people to find one another. And the horror of the Internet is that it allows like-minded people to find one another.
Right.
You know, all of us who reconnected with old high school buddies, coin collectors, stamp collectors, baseball card collectors, everybody, you know, used book people. I found all the used books I ever wanted once
right.
the Internet got going. That was wonderful. And what the Internet seemed to be for. But, of course, the Internet also allowed child molesters and neo-Nazis and communist agitators to find one another and to build an echo chamber in which their anxieties and their angers grew and grew and grew.
You and I were at the South Dakota Festival of Books. You were on a panel discussion about the Bill of Rights. I was in the audience, and there was even a moment on that day where one of the panelists, not you, but another gentleman, said something that caused the crowd, you know, to react sort of loudly, and someone shouted out, and for this brief moment, it seemed like right there in South Dakota, someone was going to get purely shouted down. And it died away quickly, but I remember looking around the room thinking, I don't think I've ever been in a South Dakota, you know, festival book space or, you know, a conversation where the entire purpose was to have, you know, civil discourse, where the audience sort of participated in that particular way. It surprised me.
It was, you know, you and I, Laurie, have spoken before about the disappearance of manners on the Internet, the kind of comments people will make that are just unbelievably vile.
Yes.
There's more of that confusion as it spreads out of the Internet into real life. You know, there used to be at least a distinction that in real life you would be mannered, well-mannered, particularly in a state that pretty much provides, you know, prides itself on its politeness. We're not Minnesota, but we're close, you know. We like to think that we're nice to one another.
Yes.
And you know, as the confusion between the virtual and the real expands, we'll see more of that. This is part of why, Laurie, on that panel, after the discussion from one of the panelists, the young man from Heritage Foundation, about how the Constitution was established, and discussion from another, an Indian trial court judge, about Indian rights, I said, all of this is fascinating, but you're arguing about the rules of shuffleboard on the deck of the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
And that this iceberg that's bearing down upon us and may have already struck our constitutional republic is the Internet, is the cyber revolution. The things that have happened to classical notions of privacy, the things that have happened to our expectations of free speech, the things that have happened to so much of what we took for granted under the old constitutional order are now gone. Privacy is eliminated in any classical sense already. That iceberg has already torn the side of the constitutional ship.
And that's why we have you back again and again. Dr. Joseph Bottom is in the head of the cyber ethics program at Dakota State University. We've been talking about a piece he had in the Weekly Standard. That's the September 25th issue. If you're looking to find that at your local library or online, the article was called The Joy of Destruction. Dr. Bottom, we'll see you next time. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.